Hi there, Con. How are you?
I'm doing well. We're just under 2 weeks away.
Did you have a nice week off last week?
I did. I had a wonderful time co-oping for the preschool. Ring Around the Rosie is a lot harder when you're close to 6 feet tall, 5'11", and everyone else is about 2 feet tall. Because if you fall down and sit on a 2 year old,
then you win.
No, you don't win. Two-year-olds, they follow each other, and they do all the time. But that's fine. You know, everything keeps going. They get up. But if I was to fall on one of them, that'd be a major problem. So getting up wasn't a problem, but the falling down the ring around the Rosie is definitely difficult.
But after your week off, you're back in the saddle for the home stretch for Election Day.
Right.
You have predicted months ago that McCain was going to lose.
I did. I'm sticking with it. Despite all the evidence.
AP poll, 1 point margin. Cling to that.
Yes, I am just as confident as I ever was.
What's that?
I said I'm just as confident as I ever was.
So the latest hiccup for the McCain campaign was this $150,000 spent on Sarah Palin's clothes and makeup.
Right.
Well, I do think part of that was for men's clothing, which we don't know who that was for.
Well, I mean, it was all bought by this Karl Rove operative, right? The political later followed up.
He was one of McCain's robocallers.
Exactly.
Correct?
He owns a robocall firm.
And I also believe he rents out an apartment to Norm Coleman.
Now, see, I did not know that.
Yeah.
You know more than I do. Whoa. Norm Coleman clothes. Weren't we just talking about a Norm Coleman clothes? Is this the same guy? Is this Norm Coleman's suit
hookup? It's not the same guy who allegedly bought Norm Coleman clothing, although Norm Coleman, since we talked, flat out denied it and kind of killed the story with his flat denial. There hasn't been any follow-up reporting that I'm aware of. I don't know if this will kick up more dust about it or not. But definitely an issue that got some blogosphere attention on the left and the right. On the left, Steve Bannon, who recently took over the Washington Monthly blogging, was doing the Carpetbagger Report, or I think still is, said, "The political implications are more than a little humiliating. Consider all the McCain campaign messages a story like this steps on. Elitist, small-town values, big spender, relating to real America, etc." Jesse Taylor at Pandagon said, "I honestly don't care that they spent this money. Image making is expensive, and it's about 60% of what presidential campaigning is. But when aw shucks Sarah the governor spends more than three times the median household income to be one of us for 10 weeks, it would seem to cut straight across the last bit of credibility the campaign has left." And also gained some flack on the right from Michelle Malkin, who said, "Heck of a job, RNC. And the RNC has squandered its time on money and a lot of stupid things." But it seemed like her objective there was to pin the blame on the RNC and keep the blame away from Sarah Palin in hopes of protecting her reputation for a 2012 run. That was my reading between the lines of it.
Yeah, my defense would be that this is only one-tenth of the amount of money the NRSC wasted on Lincoln Chafee's primary in 2006. So I call this progress. If we're only wasting $150,000 a cycle as opposed to $1.5 million on a guy that is A, going to lose, and B, going to become a Democrat anyways, this is they're getting smarter over there on 412 First Street.
What seems strange to me is, the RNC, actually the conservative movement in general, have been quite expert at digging up these small nuggets of information and extrapolating them out to make very broad character claims. Obviously, the John Edwards $400 haircut is a classic example of that. And that came out because someone at Edwards' staff put it on a campaign financial disclosure form instead of just having, the Edwards family pay out of his own pocket, and then no one would ever have known about it.
Right.
It was just sort of, and I'm sure John Edwards had no idea this was even going on until you plop him in the chair, you get the haircut, you move on the rest of your day. Obviously, the RNC knows that's how this stuff can become public. So it seems so strange that they would make the same error in an even more grandiose way. Does anyone on your side understand how this even came about?
No, no. I don't think you're going to see a lot of mental energy wasted on it. You know, people just want to know who made the decisions, who's responsible, and, you know, hopefully we'll pick better leaders next time around.
So you expect there'll be, if people are going to be calling for an RNC house cleaning after this, or are there some folks saying, hey, Sarah Palin's damaged goods here. She has not done the movement well, and let's look for Huckabee or Romney or Bobby Jindal for 2012.
Well, I didn't know this was going to turn into a 2012 conversation, which we kind of covered last week. I think it's way too early to say, you know, how much this hurts Palin. It definitely doesn't help, you know, I would still say her and Bobby Jindal right now are the front runners, but I mean we're pretty far out, so it definitely doesn't hurt. It definitely doesn't help. That's all I can say.
Is it fair to say then that there is broad displeasure with the RNC in the conservative blogosphere about this?
Oh, definitely, without a doubt.
Michelle's not an outlier.
Michelle, no, I would say she's definitely more of the consensus.
No more to say about that then.
No, not really.
House and Senate?
Right. It's looking better and better for you guys in both.
Well, 538, the blog of the year, some might say, said...
Well, he's been on Blogging Head, so on this week in blog, so I think that's safe to say.
Maybe he should sub in for me next week. I think next week's my week off. Anyway. Our Senate, this is what Nate Silver had, I think this is in Nate's post. Our Senate projections are little change from our last update 6 days ago. We currently project the composition of the new Senate to be 56.7 Democrats, 41.3 Republicans, 2 Independents. Not significantly changed from last week. We further show the Democrats having a 32% chance to control a 60-seat caucus, counting Joe Lieberman and Bernie Sanders, up incrementally from 30% last week. As before, Democrats have a fairly clear path to 59 seats, which involve picking up Virginia, New Mexico, Colorado, New Hampshire, Oregon, North Carolina, Alaska, and Minnesota, all of which they are presently favored, although in several cases only barely so. Then they could pick up a 60th seat between Mississippi, Georgia, or Kentucky, or less likely, Texas. And then in a separate post, MyDD points out, we may not know if we reach 60 until December, because if it does reach 59 and the Georgian race ends up going to a runoff, because no one gets 50%, the way the rules are there would be a runoff in December. We may be waiting a month to find out if we get to that level. But I think a lot of the projections are still around an expectation of 57. I think Mark Ambender said 57.
57 is pretty much the consensus in town.
And I believe Ambender is the one who noted that Kentucky's polls close early. Close at 6 p.m. on election night. So,
we'll know early about McConnell?
Well, if it's not a close race, we might know early about McConnell, and that might be an early indicator whether it's a real wave election or not.
That would be a good early indicator, and then I can go to bed at 9.
And that's your hope?
I know
you like your sleep.
That's always my hope. That's my hope every night.
You punted out of the Republican convention early to get some sleep, correct?
I stayed in bed some nights, but most nights I was in bed by 9.
Very good. Is there a conservative reaction now as far as the hopes of the Senate are concerned? Are there places that conservatives are focusing their energies on to try to hold the line and not have it reach 60?
You know, there has been a generic kind of hold the line rallying cry. There's been post the next right saying, you know, it's important that we don't get that we have a filibuster proof number that so we can at least stop some of what the Democrats want to do. But there's no really, really favorites that people are rallying around. I mean, you're not going to see people in the righty blogosphere rallying around the likes of Liddy Dole, who was the one who signed off on all those Lincoln Chafee expenditures I just mentioned. You're not going to see them rallying around, you know, Ted Stevens, the king of pork. As far as the close races go, there's just not a Jim Webb John Tester type that the conservative blogosphere can point to and say, this is our guy, this is where we draw the line, you know, let's help this guy win. It's more like, well, we don't want this to happen, and we hope, you know, one of the Liddies and Ted Stevens of the world can pull it out.
But is there some sense that, you know, hey, it's just fine if these folks take a good spanking, and that will help us regroup even better with this Deadwood taken out? Is that the attitude?
No. I mean, I think, you know, once you're talking about, going down to only 42 seats in the Senate, you know, even crushing majorities in the House and losing the presidency, there's no sense of, you know, please, sir, may I have another. I mean, that's pretty much enough of a butt spanking. You don't really then have to go further and say, oh, no, we really wish we would just completely lose the Senate.
I hope you're finding ways to have fun, at least, in these times.
Oh, you know, I mean, I think there definitely is for some of us a looking ahead to the fight over the next direction of the conservative movement and the how it manifests itself in the conservative arena, the Republican Party.
Do you want to shift to that, or do you want to go to a couple House things first?
Oh, no, I mean, you know, the House things are you know, kind of minor. We can go there first. Bruner's doing well, and Michelle Bachmann helped her candidate out by saying some silly things on MSNBC that the Daily Coast crowd were able to rally around.
Well, these two races, this is Darcy Bruner, who has long been a Netroots favorite.
Long time, since last cycle when she lost.
And Michelle Bachmann, probably a little more famously, is now in a tighter race than expected because of her comments on Hardball about the media should be investigating other members of Congress to see if they're anti-American or not. They struck me because, for the most part, you're not seeing too much focus.
Bill,
you're not seeing too much focus on the House because no one expects it to tip control, and there's no supermajority value that you get in the Senate. But there's definitely a Netroots focus on Bruner, and I think some concern that if she lost, that the Netroots will be blamed for. I think some of the Seattle Times endorsed her, the incumbent, and I think some folks were saying, oh, it's because Darcy's affiliated with the Netroots, and that's why she's not getting the establishment love there. And there was a lot of talk in Open Left today about an article that seemingly was baseless, that Bruner was hyping her Harvard credentials, claiming she had an economic degree when she doesn't, when in fact her own bio says that she has a computer science degree with an economic specialty. And Open Left started a big pushback on that. And I think actually got Seattle Times to change their headline on it, at least. And separately,
I saw that story, but I haven't seen a lot of the first point you made, that that there's been speculation that the Netroots may have hurt Darcy Bruner here.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know off the top of my head. I know Seattle Times did not endorse her, and I can't forgive me if I can't recall if they actually have an explicit reference about that in the endorsement.
But that's just a sneaking suspicion within your community.
Correct.
Okay. I haven't seen that vocalized publicly in your community.
I'll have to check, see if I have a link about that.
Okay.
I don't remember where that exactly came from, but I think there is an underlying concern about that. And I personally don't think it would be fair to, you know, judge a single candidate on that or not. But I think having her win the entire Netroots community is all about, quote-unquote, more and better Democrats. They don't want to just see Democratic margins increase. They want progressive Democrats in those slots, and they see Darcy as someone who stood with them on FISA, stood with them on the bailout and things like that.
Yes, well, it's easy to stand with them on FISA when you don't have to vote, but like Barack Obama, sometimes that changes when the actual vote's on the line.
A lot of folks in the Netroots weren't happy with Obama about that decision. So that's why they want folks who they think will stand with them, even when they do have the need to vote. And on the Michelle Bachmann side, that is, I noticed that Powerline said with some dismay that the NRCC was pulling funds from her race, and was incredulous about that, and was calling for other bloggers to step up and and help her out.
Their language was more gentle than Eric Erickson's at Red State, who had some very choice words for Tom Cole.
Do you know, has Tom Cole made an explanation why that's even happening? Because this was considered a likely, a relatively safe seat until those comments. It would seem a pretty drastic decision to pull funding from that just because of one interview.
No, I haven't seen a detailed explanation from Cole about why that was happening. Cole doesn't have a great relationship already with the conservative blogger community. He's more supportive of pork, and he said early on that everyone down ballot needs to kind of line up and get behind McCain, and I think the exact line was tie themselves to McCain, which for conservative Netroots, who was never that much in love with McCain, was just not really a rallying cry for us. So Tom Cole, unpopular before, still unpopular.
But is there a broader blogger rallying around Michelle Bachmann at this point?
I've seen more condemnation of Tom Cole than of Go Michelle Go. If you can get that distinction.
Well, House and Senate aside, to get back to where the conservative movement goes from here question. You think there's been some steps towards, not towards increased factionalizing, but towards some reconnecting around common principles?
Right. It's happening earlier than I thought it would. I thought we would at least have to wait, at least until Barack Obama was sworn in. But, thanks to journalists like Jacob Weisberg at Slate, who want to push the narrative that free markets caused the financial turmoil and that libertarianism is dead. He wrote a Slate article. I'll quote for it really quickly. A source of mild entertainment amid the financial carnage has been watching libertarians scurrying to explain how the global financial crisis is the result of too much government intervention rather than too little. To summarize, the libertarian apologetics fall wildly short of providing any convincing explanation for what went wrong. The argument as a whole is reminiscent of wearying dorm room debates that took place circa 1989 about whether the fall of the Soviet bloc demonstrated the failure of communism. So Jonah Goldberg at the corner then had a very short post that just said, feed libertarians, feed, and linked to this Weisberg article. And not that I think they needed their encouragement, but there is a wide response from the libertarian community, attacking Weisberg. I'll read a couple of them, but I want to start with Brink first, because Brink Lindsay over at Cato had a dialogue with Jane Hampshire a while ago this year. Well, they are talking about possibly a libertarian liberal renaissance under Obama, or at least dissatisfaction with Bush. And Brink was talking about, possible common ground between them and how they could all get along. But after a little taste of Jake Weisberg, Brink seems to be singing a slightly different tune. This is Brink. With regard to government intervention as a cause of the crisis, Charles Calamaris and Peter Wallison have marshaled strong evidence that Fannie and Freddie played a major role in inflating the real estate bubble, which we've talked about, Bill. Despite the fact that these two gentlemen have forgotten more about financial markets than Weisberg will ever know, Weisberg dismisses their analysis as not only wrong but risible. Weisberg's simplistic morality tale that good, prudent liberals were foiled by go-go free marketers doesn't come close to mapping reality accurately. When did Democrats try to assert and reverse the steady relaxation of lending standards? When did Democrats try to rein in the government-sponsored entities? Meanwhile, European banks are being battered by the crisis as well. Does anybody really think that European financial regulators are closet libertarians? So that's just a small sampling.
Will libertarians ever be happy?
I don't know. I think Brink's most of the time happy. But they're definitely coming around. I don't want to make it seem, though, that as soon as Obama's sworn into office, everything's going to be well within the conservative establishment. Radley Balko at Reason had an article talking, I guess, kind of along the lines you were saying about how he desperately wants the GOP to get their butt kicked this year. He talked about how he voted for Dole in 96 and Bush in 2000, but he got fed up and voted for Kerry in 2004. And Radley writes, "If they do lose, the GOP would be wise to regroup and rebuild from scratch. Scrap the current leadership, and most importantly, purge the party of the national greatness, neoconservative influence," which is a direct shot at David Brooks and Michael Gerson and, to a lesser extent, Roth, Douthat, and co. "Big government conservatism has bloated the federal government, bogged us down, and will ultimately be a $1 trillion war, and set us down the road to European-style socialism. It's hard to think of how Obama could be worse. He'll just be bad in different ways." Which brings me back to why the Republicans need to get throttled. A humiliated, decimated GOP that rejuvenates and rebuilds around the principles of limited government, free markets, and rugged individualism is really the only chance for voters to possibly get a real choice in federal elections down the road. Of course, there's no guarantee that's how the party will emerge from defeat, but the Republican Party in its current form has forfeited its right to govern. And just speaking of another dialogue between libertarians, Megan and Dan Dresner, Dan was making a very similar point, is that in the past 8 years, and we can go back from that, from Tom DeLay's coup on, the Republicans have been completely betrayal of their limited government selves, and there's really not much you can point to as accomplishments since then. So we'll see. There's definitely work to be done for the GOP and the libertarians to get together. I like to think of it as a married couple who have separated, but they need to go to marriage counseling to reconcile and work out their ways.
I would think that the divisions would probably run deeper than that. I mean, I'm sure you must have social conservatives complaining that the Republican Party didn't tend to their needs enough, and you have libertarians complaining that there was too much spending and invasions in civil liberties. And I'm sure there are corporate folks that are pointing fingers at the social conservatives saying you're making it impossible for us to win in the middle. I would think those would be more fundamental divisions that might be harder to quickly reconcile.
Oh, well, I said it was going to be easy. I thought it said there's lots of work to be done.
Sure.
You know, you definitely have the Michael Gersons and the David Brooks and to a somewhat lesser extent the Ross and Rahans of the world who have their view of what the party should look like.
And David Brooks has Patio Man on his side, and yeah, that guy's fierce.
That guy doesn't exist, Bill.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
He's a fictional character.
He's a fictional character. So, I guess maybe naively, because I'm young, I'm looking forward to this fight. I think
burst of intellectual explosion.
I think after a good decade of Tom DeLay, George Bush, it's a fight that needs to be had.
Heady times. Well, perhaps maybe that segues into our taxes discussion.
It does actually.
Because I have my own suggestion for you guys. In the course of that.
It does actually segue into our tax discussion. So I'll let you start that one.
Well, for those who saw the Week in Blog last week, Amanda Carpenter and I had a back and forth about Obama's tax plan when she repeated the canard that Obama wants to give checks from your money to people who don't pay taxes. And cited Kimberly Strassel from the Wall Street Journal, who said as much. I dug a little deeper afterwards and noted that, yes, it's true that 30% of so-called taxable units, people who have...
individual filers or families.
Thank you. 30% of those don't technically pay federal income taxes, but anyone who works still pays payroll taxes on their income. And that is a flat regressive tax. That's a 15.3% tax on income below $102,000 earned in a year. So anyone making above that has a smaller portion of their income being taxed for payroll taxes. And while that's often advertised as something that is siphoned off specifically for Social Security and Medicare, in reality it isn't. That good chunk of that goes into the general fund, as the rest of income tax does.
Well, what do you mean a good chunk of that? I mean, because I happen to have my paste of it. I mean, if you're making the point that there's no such thing as a Social Security trust fund and that Medicare and Social Security taxes just go into the big gob of the government pot and they spend it, I'll concede that. Conservatives have always tried to establish that point. But if you're trying to say that there's some part of the payroll tax that is different than the income deduction, that the income part that they take off, and FICA, that no part of FICA goes into the general fund. FICA is supposed to just go to Social Security and Medicare. So, because you had your own post responding to one I wrote, and you said, and I quote here, "But as I noted before, the payroll tax, which is also taxing your income, is not fully dedicated to those trust funds, and some of the revenue goes into the general fund as the income tax." And so that's true. The part of the payroll tax that goes into the income tax is the income tax portion. So when Amanda and I say that 38% of Americans don't pay income tax, we're already talking about that part of the income tax. So if these people, these 38%, yes, they're still paying the payroll tax, but if Obama is going to be giving all of them a tax cut cutting them a check, that means that that money is either A, coming from other people who are making more money, like Joe the plumber or other businesses.
Or B,
coming from the FICA taxes. Those are the only two possible sources it could come from.
No, it would be coming from the general fund. But
the general fund is either other people's income taxes or other business, other people's money.
Those are the only two sources. Hold on. I'm quoting from Jay Bookman here.
Right.
So two points. Jay Bookman, Atlanta Journal-Constitution, quote, "Technically, payroll tax recipients are supposed to be – payroll tax receipts are supposed to be reserved for paying for Social Security and Medicare, which is what allows some people to claim it is not income tax. However, in practice, that distinction was abandoned long ago. For decades now, the payroll tax has been bringing in a lot more revenue than needed for Social Security, and the excess has been siphoned off for general fund use like any other government money. Last year alone, $190 billion in payroll tax receipts, and overall payroll taxes bring in $873 billion. So $190 billion payroll tax receipts was diverted to general fund use, paying for everything from Iraq to the salaries of park rangers." So that's the amount of – when I say a chunk, that's what I mean. Now, as far as how Obama's tax credit would work, it would be a refundable tax credit.
But I just want to point out that what you're admitting is that there's really no such thing as the Social Security and Medicare Trust Fund, and that it's all just a big federal pot of money that it goes to, which, as conservative, I'm fine with you admitting that.
Well, I'm not admitting that. Those are the numbers.
Key to your analysis,
just
though. When you try to use that Bookman analysis to say that a large part of the FICA tax is actually goes to the general funds, that's the point you're conceding, is that it is just a big pot of money.
I'm not conceding anything. This is not it's not a matter of opinion. That's just a fact about where the money goes.
No, I mean, the fact is that there's not a, you know, mythical Social Security trust fund where this money is sitting. Is that every year it's a pyramid scheme.
That's true.
It's a pyramid Ponzi scheme from day one.
Well,
and all the money that is paid in has been going out the door, as soon as the Social Security system was created over 70 years ago.
It's a logical jump to say just because there is not an actual lockbox, which Al Gore wanted to have and that doesn't exist. It's a jump from that to say that it's a pyramid Ponzi scheme.
Not a leap. But what was your suggestion?
That's a whole separate discussion about Social Security and Medicare. If you want to debate that, we can debate that. But as far as what is just factually true, part of the payroll tax gets siphoned off for general fund use, and the payroll tax is a flat regressive tax. So to say now, and if conservatives want to argue about income taxes and refundable tax credits, that's fine. But both in your post on Heritage and Amanda and Kimberly Strassel in the Wall Street Journal and other conservatives, when they say Obama wants to give checks to people who don't pay any taxes, that is false, flat false.
And
my point in saying that, and we can talk more about the tax thing in particular, but as far as getting it back to where the conservative movement goes from here. I would argue that the conservative movement has been trafficking in misinformation to win arguments for a very long time, and that has caught up with you. And the quicker you get off of that stuff and have an intellectual regrouping, how do we articulate our arguments in a factual way, I think we'd be better off.
This is just sloppiness. The point is still 100% correct, which you already admitted, that 38% of Americans don't pay income tax.
But they pay other taxes. And if you, some of them flat and regressive.
Can you read my post that I wrote and not see that I talk about payroll taxes and Social Security, Medicare?
The post you were talking about people who never pay taxes, and those people don't exist. There's no person who never pays taxes. Everybody pays some taxes. Even if you're poor and destitute, when you buy a scrap of food, you pay a sales tax. Everyone pays some
taxes.
Now
you're talking about a completely different tax. I'll admit to being sloppy when I said don't pay any tax. I meant any income tax specifically.
Okay.
Because, of course, everyone pays payroll taxes. But that's just the thing about Obama's earned income tax credit, is that more and more people are paying zero income tax. And, of course, we're all paying payroll tax, but a larger and larger percentage are paying absolutely no income tax. And so
if in Obama's tax plan,
right,
a larger percentage of people would not pay any income tax at all.
Correct.
But they still pay other taxes. They're still contributing to the operation of government in some way.
Let's keep
What's
it just federal here, because you're bringing in a whole other thing when you say sales taxes, because sales taxes are all state.
Well, state and local, but payroll tax is federal.
Let's just stick to the payroll.
So gas taxes are federal. There are phone taxes that I believe are both state and federal. But the payroll tax is the biggie on the federal side. So they're still contributing to the operations of government. They're not getting off scot-free. And obviously the implication in saying, when people say, Obama wants to take some of your money, Joe the plumber's money, take it out of your pocketbook, and give it to some lazy, shiftless person who doesn't pay any income tax, that's concocting an entire scenario which doesn't exist. We are trying to help people who are working and playing by the rules so they can get through this economic hard time with more money in their pocket. This is a side that conservatives used to support. They used to support the negative income tax. It's Milton Friedman saying it's easier to do that than to have a anti-poverty government program. So I don't understand why conservatives are piling all over this unless it's just for political gain to try to beat up on Obama with fake information.
Well, because the worry is that we're reaching a point where a majority of people aren't going to be paying income tax. And what does this do when most people in the country don't feel like they have to rein in spending because they don't have any income tax? So Adam Larick, who is a professor of economics at Carnegie Mellon, wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal about Obama and the taxing tipping point. He writes, in 2006, the latest year for which we have census data, 220 million Americans were eligible to vote, and 89 million, 40%, paid no income taxes. According to the Tax Policy Center, this will jump to 49% when Mr. Obama's cash credits remove 18 million more voters from the tax rolls. What's more, there are an additional 24 million taxpayers, 11% of the electorate, who will pay minimal amounts of income taxes, less than 5% of their income, and less than $1,000 annually. In all, 3 out of 5 voters will pay little or nothing in income taxes under Mr. Obama's plans and gain when taxes rise on the 40% that already pays 95% of income tax revenues.
Now,
this is his point. Voters who benefit from government programs will push for higher taxes on higher earners, at least until those who power the economy and create jobs and wealth stop working, stop investing, or move out of the country. So that is the ultimate concern, is that once you have a majority of the people who are paying nothing or next to nothing in income taxes, what does that do to our already very feeble controls on federal spending?
Well, number one, he cites the Tax Policy Center. You and I talked about this before. I'm trying to find the actual Tax Policy Center paper he's referring to. I'm not saying it doesn't exist. I'm saying I didn't find it. And it wouldn't be the first time where I've seen a conservative columnist twist a number around. So I just want to try
to
find it.
Well, this isn't Bill Kristol. This is a professor at Carnegie Mellon. It's his job and his tenure on the line, not mine. But the accompanying graphic has slightly different numbers. It has 48.1% instead of 49 and 38% instead of 40. But those are all still in the ball for getting. And you can see the 38% number.
Well, that's I'm getting that from Jay Bookman
right.
at the Atlanta.
Right. And so 49% is definitely within the ballpark.
So let's take it at face value then for the sake of discussion.
Okay.
In his piece, again, he does the same sleight of hand. People will be taken off the tax rolls. He, again, lends the impression, creates a false perception that there's this half of the country is not involved in funding the operations of government in any way, shape, or form. When if you're paying the 15.3% payroll tax, you most certainly are. So, the income tax, I'm going to look at the Jay Bookman column.
There's no sleight of hand. He says income taxes.
Taking off the tax rolls makes it sound like they're not contributing to government at all.
Well, they're definitely contributing, a lot less.
The income tax brings in $1.17 trillion. The payroll tax brings in $873.4 billion. So they bring in a roughly similar amount of money. It's not an insignificant tax, the payroll tax.
No, you're right, it's not. But especially with these earned income tax credits, the number
Republican idea, I might add. A refundable tax credit's a Republican idea.
The refundable tax was a good idea, but what it has spurred, and this is why I thought the tax discussion would be a good transition, is that you have the Ross and Rayens and the David Frums of the world and even the Ramesh Panurus wanting to do more and more basically spending within using the tax code. And Howard Gleckman at the Tax Policy Center had a good post about this today. For all of that, however, McCain does raise some important issues. What is it with Obama's, may I say, liberal use of the refundable credit? He'd give them to working families, homeowners who don't itemize, parents whose kids are in child care, savers, employers who hire new workers, and, of course, buyers of health insurance. Oh, and he'd once again expand the earned income tax credit. All of this fumes McCain is spending. And on that point, McCain is largely correct, not only about refundable credits, but about all sorts of other tax expenditures aimed at both individuals and businesses. One can argue that the EITC is a backdoor way to cut payroll taxes for low-wage workers without messing with Social Security, but it is much harder for Obama and McCain to make the case for refundable health care credits. These are not tax credits in any meaningful sense of the word. They are vouchers. Obama admits as much when he claims in mock outrage that McCain would be giving his credit directly to insurance companies. Well, of course he would. Who else would buy the insurance? McCain is right that this is spending and drag, and there are good reasons to ask whether we really want the IRS to run both our welfare and health care systems, as well as our energy and investment policies. After all, at the moment, it is having enough trouble collecting the taxes it is owed. So,
I think that at least is an honest critique of the refundable tax credits that Obama was talking about. It spells out what they are. It shows that they are for people who work, people who save, pay for education, for childcare. And he still doesn't like them. He still thinks that there's too much of them. And he offers a critique of them. I think that's a legitimate policy debate to have. What we have not seen from most of the conservative movement is not that kind of reason discussion, but to create a fake scenario of Obama wants to take your money as if 90% of the country isn't getting a tax cut from him, and he's picking your pocket to give it to people who don't pay taxes to make it sound like you're giving money to a bunch of lazy, shitless, irresponsible people. And if that's the kind of argumentation that conservatives insist upon after there is this spanking in November, I don't think they're going to regain much credibility in future elections.
No, I think you're missing the point here, is that there's going to be a debate within the conservative movement about the value of trying to enact social policies and social spending through the tax code. Is that, the conservative movement did a great job throughout the late 70s and the early 80s and into the 90s, successfully demonizing government spending as liberal, and so that nobody really wants to propose a lot of new spending. But the downside to that is that the Republican Party got very addicted to labeling everything a tax cut. So you have targeted tax cuts for everybody. There's a laundry list there, but there's a laundry list of other business tax cuts that I'm sure you hate. And there's definitely a divide within the conservative movement about what the relative value of that is going forward, of whether it's worth it to keep doing narrow targeted tax cuts that further complicate the tax code, whether they're for families with children, single people, entrepreneurs, small businesses, whatever. If we want to keep going down that line and play that game, or whether or not we say, no, enough is enough. These tax cuts are all just, as this guy says, spending and drag, and we need to have a fundamental return to Reagan, 1986, simplify the tax code shift within the party. And that's the debate you're going to see on the right after this election.
If that debate is had in an intellectually honest way, you guys might get somewhere.
It's good to know you'll be polling for me.
My only selfish interest in this, to be honest with you, is it's very. I don't like going into these discussions having to have to second guess every fact that's thrown at me. I just find it very, very tiresome.
Well, then, politics isn't a good field.
What's that?
I said then politics isn't a good field for you.
As the conservative movement regroups,
yes,
Peter Dow, I think, is trying to make sure the Netroots gets its due.
Right.
And he had a big post. Now, Peter Dow is someone who worked for Kerry and then I believe he still works for Hillary Clinton as a Netroots outreach person. He had one of the more celebrated posts in blog history called The Triangle, about how bloggers should be working along with the party establishment folks to exert pressure on the national media the way conservative talk radio works the Republican Party establishment.
Which, very briefly, is I think you see something completely not working on the conservative movement this election campaign.
You got Acorn out there.
We had to beat McCain up for a long, long time to get him to talk about it.
But you still did.
Eventually.
The triangle still works.
But it was completely compromised because McCain worked with Acorn on amnesty.
Well, that's why, that's true.
We're agreeing that the triangle is an important concept and that ours was compromised this time around because of our nominee.
But Dow wrote in the Huffington Post, one thing that shouldn't be overlooked is the tortured path to that day, a positive election day, and the ragtag group of activists who, from fear of knowing that America had taken a terrible turn at the dawn of the millennium, embraced a new medium and labored tirelessly, thanklessly defending the Constitution and the rule of law. Day after day, they congregate on websites, blogs, message boards, and any other online forum they could find to write, debate, argue, and resist a radical administration and a lockstep Republican Party. Mocked and feared, dismissed as angry, and treated with disdain, they fought their opponents, fought their own party, fought the media, fought one another, all to a single end, the defense of inviolable American ideals against a brazen onslaught from a shameful and shameless administration. We should acknowledge that the Netroots kept hope alive when our systems of checks and balances was in mortal danger, kept hope alive when civil liberties were fast becoming disposable niceties. We should realize back when Bill Mott and Bob Summerby and a gentle soul with a sharp pen named Steve Gilliard were required reading, when Digby was a mystery man and Fire Dog Lake was a new blog with an intriguing name, when citizens across the country began logging on and conversing from the heart, there was no glory in political blogging. There still isn't. No one knew if blogs would become quaint artifacts. Many hoped they would. Blogging was about speaking up for America's guiding principles, liberty, justice, equality, opportunity, and democracy. And I think there's a lot to that. I'm not sure this election would gone the way it was there not a medium for liberals and progressives to get together, launch ideas, push messages, take shots at people and move them into the broader traditional media discourse, something that liberals have been very frustrated about for a long time, how conservatives were able to do it so effortlessly, and those on the left have started to figure out how that gets done.
I would just say, Katrina, Iraq, and the recent financial meltdown all created some pretty strong winds. However, you still need someone to put up the sail and capture those wins and get the boat to go in the direction you want it to. And in that sense, I do think the Netroots has helped shape the Democratic Party as what it looks like today. There's no doubt about it.
I completely agree that all those external events that you talk about are, you know, are probably the most important things as far as the tenor of the election is concerned. But I would say there was a time when, you know, bloggers were hitting McCain at not being a maverick and being truly a conservative. And a lot of party establishment people and a lot of media people are like, oh, that will never work. McCain is a maverick. You're never going to take that veneer off of him.
That was before he was the official nominee against D1. Once that happened, all bets were off.
Well, once that happened, I think the party people got in line. You saw a lot of media pundits still kind of push back at it, saying it was a silly tactic. We know McCain. We know he really is a maverick, and that's never going to fly. And you have seen that his biggest problem has been the notion that he votes with Bush 90% of the time. And I don't know if that would have been pushed out as fiercely if bloggers had taken the lead on that.
Well, I guess, you know, the title of Peter's post is what again?
I don't know.
Oh, it's important.
I didn't cut and paste that.
Oh, I forget, too. It's something along the line of, the Netroots deserves its due, right?
Right. I'm gonna try to pull it up. And,
okay.
But I won't.
Well, anyways, the point is that
on November 4th, the Netroots will be more than an afterthought.
There you go, more than an afterthought.
Yeah.
So, my point is that there was a Newsweek cover piece out this week by John Meacham, talking about how this is really a center right country, and Obama's going to have to govern America as David Sirota says, a slightly more moderate Ronald Reagan, and so there's. Actually, a lot less pushback on this article than I was expecting when I first saw it. David Sirota had a post on it.
I had a post on it.
Some guy named Bill Scherr had a post on it. I'll just read Sirota's and then Armando's. I thought Armando's were better, but we'll do David's first. The question will be how much of this kind of smug propaganda emanating from media megaphones in New York City and Washington, D.C. will impact a President Obama, who will at least officially be in office that is supposed to represent more than the public opinion of Manhattan cocktail parties and Bethesda fundraisers. I'm not sure. And the one chance I discussed this issue with Obama, he showed both strong progressive inclinations but also hesitation to challenge the parameters created by the elite. And so you better believe that if we want real change, it's going to require sustained pressure from the progressive movement, pressure that shows just how totally out of touch the John Meachams of the world really are. Armando wrote, the title of his post was Define the Middle. And he first quotes Meacham, FDR had a longest run from 1933 to 1937, but he lost significant ground in the 1938 midterm elections and again in the largely forgotten wartime midterms of 1942. Armando responds, well, sure, if you put it that way, FDR was center-right. What a load of nonsense. But consider the advantage of having the New Deal defined as center-right. We are talking about a truly progressive and virtually revolutionary period, and consider the fact that a Democrat won four consecutive presidential elections and dominated the Congress for five decades. For Meacham, this is a sign of the limits of progressivism. Heck, if that defines center-right for Meacham, then give me some center-right. Embrace the term centrism, own it, define it, do not get mad about it. So what was your take on it?
I think both those takes are not necessarily diametrically opposite to each other.
No, they're not.
Little tweak as far as tactics are concerned, but I do think and I'm very much in single sorta on this. One, you can't presume that Obama is going to do everything that liberals would like. He's not a party line liberal, and it's just not how the political system is structured. And I think there is a broad understanding within the progressive movement that it is going to be time to push post election day.
That is the number one overriding message I got out of my time in Denver.
Yeah. And I think there's a recognition that there are going to be lots of John Meekums out there that are going to be trying to undermine any sense of a progressive mandate from the election. I would argue not based on a whole lot of evidence, having read his piece. And it's going to be incumbent upon nothing can be presumed. We're going to have to re-argue a lot of issues. We're going to have to argue these tax issues again. We're going to have to argue public investment issues. And I think the big dividing line, this is where I took my own post in reaction to Meekum's pieces, you know, the big dividing line is going to be in recession during this financial crisis when there is this $700 billion rescue package. A lot of pundits are going to say, there's no money to do anything else. All your wild and crazy schemes, all this investment you want to do in clean energy and education and infrastructure and healthcare, you're going to have to put that to the side because the money is just not there. And there needs to be an argument made, a debate to be had to say, wait a second, there's another way to look at this. And there are a lot of folks like Robert Reich, like Larry Summers, like Paul Krugman, that would say, the public investment is the key to getting out of the recession, getting kind of back on track short term and long term, and to focus on deficits in the short run is not the responsible thing to do. You see in the media a lot, and I had a post on this today, you know, the LA Times talking about increased deficits as inherently bad without ever making an argument that it's bad, just sort of taking it as an accepted fact, when it's a point of dispute, at least. And that argument needs to be had, and I think it's going to be the biggest policy fault line that's going to separate, you know, establishment pundits from Netroots and progressive movement, and arguably within the Democratic Party itself to some respect. And that argument's going to have to be hashed out, and I bet it's going to be hashed out in a big way between November 4th and Inauguration Day.
So we agree the fun does not end but starts on November 4th.
For those of us on the left, the work begins.
Which is just vacation time for those of us on the right.
I don't want to presume what you guys are going to do.
We just talked about all the fighting we're going to do. Let me just close with this. It's sure. A post from Greg Mankiw. It was a very short post. All it did was say flashback, and it linked to an International Herald Tribune article from 1993. The headline is, Clinton now says the big things never included his tax cut vow. Sitting to explain why he is backtracking on a campaign promise to cut taxes for the middle class, President-elect Bill Clinton said Thursday that the plan was never a major theme in his race for the White House. Mr. Clinton, speaking at a news conference a day after saying he would have to revisit his tax cut plan, said Americans voted for him because of big things he wanted to do. The middle class tax cut, he said, was not among them. But in the week since his election, two big things have changed. The government's estimate of the growth of the federal budget deficit over the next 5 years has grown about $60 billion, which is kind of a quaint number. Also, the new team of Clinton economic advisors has apparently made new calculations and concluded that the tax cut idea is not terrible if Mr. Clinton wants to reduce the deficit and also move ahead with an investment program to revive the economy. So just a little history repeats itself. Thought for everyone to close. Well,
we don't know if it's going to repeat or not.
It's true, but the issues are all there.
The backdrop of the economy is very different.
Rising deficits, the middle class tax cut, a new president. Does he have the money to do the big things he wants to do? And we'll see if Obama becomes Clinton's third term.
We'll see. I mean, I think there is an attitude on the left that there wasn't a lot of preparation pre-Clinton's inauguration to push on these issues. And a presumption that these things would sort of fall into place because, you know, we had the numbers in Washington and that's not the way the political system works. Secondly, I think the issues with, you know, Robert Reich pointed out in his column that the problems with crumbling infrastructure are much more pronounced now than they were in the early 90s. The healthcare problem is worse. The energy crisis is more pronounced. So there's definitely more sense of urgency on these issues that require public investment from a liberal perspective. I can just leave it at that, I suppose. But I do think that, you know, it is a lesson that just because it's said in the campaign doesn't mean it automatically becomes policy reality. People still need to push and argue and legislate.
That's true. Nothing that Obama has said is going to tie him down come January.
Agreed.
Cool. Well, we will talk to each other, I guess, in 2 weeks.
Yes, I'll take off next week, and then we'll do post-election.
There you go. Talk to you later, Bill.
Take care.